From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, I'm Paris Alston. Welcome to Consider This from Boston, where the pandemic has put a disproportionate financial strain on low-income and first-generation medical and law school students. Money has been tight for many of these students and their families over the past year, which has resulted in some tension around the financial aid policy called summer contribution. WBUR's Carrie Young has been taking a look at how this has unfolded for some area law school students, and she joins us now to talk about it. Hey, Carrie, how's it going?
Hey, Paris. Thanks for having me on.
So help us understand the summer contribution policy. I mean, it sounds like it creates a few caveats when it comes to need-based financial aid for these students.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the way you look at it. Several financial aid experts explained to me that the idea of a summer contribution for graduate students, and this is specifically a thing for medical and law school students with paid internships, is that, you know, it does fit in with the way that need-based aid is supposed to work. The amount of funding you get depends on how much financial need you have. So theoretically, when your means increase, your financial need decreases. Need-based aid and these summer contributions aren't really a new thing, but this year, this idea has hit a lot of students particularly hard because the pandemic and the related recession were so devastating for a lot of people's families. One of those students I spoke with recently was Stacey Menhivar, and here's Menhivar in her own words.
My father hasn't worked since March of 2020, and he was, you know, the primary earner in our family. My mother has begun working again, but she still is being paid the wage that people are paid when you don't have a high school diploma.
Now, Menhivar says she really wanted to help her parents out this summer just to pay bills, pay rent, because they sacrificed so much to help her get to college and to law school. She thought she might finally be able to do that once she started earning money at her summer clerkship, which, these clerkships aren't your typical summer job. They can pay law students upwards of $30,000 a season. But she remembered that actually much of that money had to be given back to Harvard Law School because of this summer contribution.
Wait, really?
Yeah, I mean, so for schools, like I was saying, the argument there is theoretically your wealth is going up when you earn that money. So you have more means to pay your tuition. Menhivar says she understands the reasoning here, but it still feels really unfair, especially during the pandemic. And she says, especially for low-income and first-generation students, it feels kind of like it's acting almost like a gatekeeper.
So none of this has been easy. And to now tell me that when my parents need the most help, I can't help them because you need my money and you need this income, it's outrageous, it's callous, it's insensitive, and it is inequitable.
Yeah, that does sound pretty unfair, Carrie, especially given the reality of the past year. So what's Harvard's response to all this?
Well, Harvard officials said that they couldn't legally comment specifically on Menhivar's case, but in an email, they did say that they are giving renewed attention to how they support low-income and first-generation students. These officials also pointed out a new grant program that they have since the pandemic aimed at helping students with the highest financial need. And experts I spoke with who are familiar with the law school industry say that, you know, these summer contributions have been a pain point for a really long time. They've been hearing them from students for a good many years. But again, it's been exacerbated by the pandemic, and some schools are starting to respond.
We have seen law schools, particularly over the last year, making sure that they're trying to do whatever they can to accommodate.
So that's Leandra Ross, who works with Access Lex, which is a nonprofit focused on making legal education more accessible. And Ross says that if students don't have friends or family members who have experience with law school or financial aid in general, they're also kind of in a disadvantage too, because they're likely not going to know that they can ask for an adjustment or an appeal on their financial aid program.
They don't know what they don't know. All they know is that you're taking this money that I'm earning and using it to calculate my next year's financial aid. And there's nothing I can do about it because you've detailed it out on the website. And that signals to me that it is what it is.
And that's a hard position to be in as a student, I can imagine. So is there a way to sort of demystify all of this for families? I mean, it really seems like it comes down to a communication problem.
Yeah, I mean, what I heard from the folks at Access Lex, for example, was, you know, read your financial aid policy before you agree to sign on with a program. it is a communication thing from what I've heard as well. A lot of people just don't know that there is this professional judgment that you can appeal to. It also doesn't help that these summer contributions aren't a thing at every law school. It's really just the most competitive law schools, like Harvard Law School, that have them. And that's because their financial aid programs are only need-based. Other schools do use financial aid scholarships, but they're merit-based instead. And that means they also don't have these contributions because it's not based on your need. So if you've got a friend at a different institution and you're comparing your situation, then that tension increases again. Now, just like a lot of things in this world these days, this tension around this policy can be seen on Twitter, which, like I said, is not a surprise. The student I spoke with, Stacey Menjivar, maintains that Harvard Law School denied her request for an adjustment, which is what led her to tweet about it, and that tweet went mildly viral. It did seem to strike a nerve, clearly, because thousands of people weighed in with a variety of viewpoints. I mean, for example, one person said that they were a fellow needs-based Harvard Law School student with a 9-month-old child to take care of, and he thanked Menjivar for, quote, calling the problem out, saying that he literally needs every penny to afford the school. Another person tweeted out a comparison to indentured servitude, but there were a good many comments on the opposite end of things. Other tweeters seemed to think that Stacey was being a brat, given the substantial 6-figure salary she'd likely accrue after graduation. Now, leaders with the nonprofit Access Lex add that while this debate is, like I said, longstanding, what is different this summer is that the pandemic is just, you know, heightening this issue and bringing it into a super sharp focus. And a lot of these schools do say they're working on it, so we'll be watching.
And we'll be following along. That's WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Thanks so much for reporting on this.
Thanks, Paris.
Before we go, I should tell you what else is up. The last of the state's 7 mass vaccination sites shut down today as demand for the vaccine wanes across the Commonwealth. Located at the Old Circuit City store in Dartmouth, the site has administered more than 76,000 doses since opening in late February and will still serve as a pop-up vaccination site several times a week this summer. Karen Riscacci, State Director of Nursing for Curative Incorporated, which operates the facility, says demand for the vaccine is less than 10% of what it was when the site first opened.
Many residents waited hours to get appointments. There were lines outside the buildings. Obviously, as the months have gone on and the availability has been there, we've seen the numbers decrease.
Around the state, nearly 4.72 million people have been fully vaccinated to date. That's about 67% of the population. But more than 2 million residents remain unvaccinated, even as the highly contagious Delta variant is fast becoming the dominant strain of COVID in the Commonwealth. And cases are inching back up, now reaching a 7-day positive test rate of 0.55%, the highest it's been since early June. As of today, 101 people are hospitalized with COVID in Massachusetts. And finally, State Representative John Santiago is ending his bid to become Boston's next mayor. A June 1st poll from Suffolk University and the Boston Globe showed Santiago polling just under 5%, well behind the two frontrunners, acting Mayor Kim Janey and City Councilor Michelle Wu.
It's been an honor to join this historic field of candidates. I am deeply proud of the race I've run, the relationships made, and the impact our campaign has had.
With a little less than 4 months to go until Election Day and 5 major candidates remaining, I think we're in for an interesting race. From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, the greatest combo since city politics and our reporting on it, I'm Paris Alston. Be well. Way. Every day you hear us tackle news in Boston on Consider This. Well, another one of WBUR's programs uses a wider lens. On Point, hosted by Meghna Chakrabarty, sets out to make sense of the world together. From the economy and healthcare to politics and the environment and so much more, On Point talks with newsmakers and real people about the issues that matter most. Get the On Point podcast wherever you listen. Just search On Point and hit subscribe.